And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning and welcome, and thank you for joining us this morning. It's a holiday for many, and it's today we honor Martin Luther King and his vast accomplishments in advancing civil rights for African Americans. He was assassinated because of his beliefs and because of the movement he led. Certainly was a courageous American who led a movement that was far too long in coming, and we must remember what this day is all about. Today, we'll speak with Mark Redman, the Executive Director of Spectrum Youth and Family Services, and we'll talk about what his organization does, how it does it, and the trends he is seeing in our troubled youth population. And of course, you're always invited to our conversation, so call in at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. A couple of things before we get to our guests this morning. First off, Marty Seawright died over the weekend from cancer. Many of you may not know Marty, but you know of her work. In the treasurer's office, she was in charge of the abandoned property division and worked tirelessly to reunite people with money they either had forgotten or didn't even know that they had. In the governor's office, she was in charge of the office you called if you had a complaint and wanted to bring it to the governor's attention. I had the pleasure to know and work with Marty for many years. At one time when I was younger, her son Keith and I would venture to South America to climb mountains. He, like her, had an inner desire to strive for achievement. She was a tireless worker for the state of Vermont, her political party, her family, and her friends. She was generous, spirited, and passionate about issues, and extremely loyal to Governor Douglas, as well as a trusted friend to him and all of us who worked on the fifth floor during those days. Vermont has truly lost a wonderful woman, and my heart goes out to her family for their loss. In the second hour today, I want to explore a lot of things. I realized over the weekend that we've been so busy that I haven't given the opportunity for you to weigh in on the governor's state of the speech. We've talked to politicians about it. We've talked to analysts about it. But I haven't talked to you about it and gathered your opinions about it. That speech was almost about 2 weeks ago, with the budget speech coming up on Thursday. We'll take some time today and explore some of the things said in the governor's state of the state address. One of the things that stuck out at me was he had proposed to mandate that medical professionals could only prescribe 10 pills for pain for minor procedures. The governor said, and this is quoting the governor, "First, we are putting an end to the system where doctors, dentists, and healthcare providers send patients home with 80 or 90 pills in their pocket. I am proposing a new system where a maximum of 10 pills will be the limit for minor procedures. We're also looking at reasonable limits for more major procedures that provide pain relief without filling up our medicine cabinets with unused opiates. That's just Vermont's common sense." So my question that I want to explore is, do you think this is a good idea for government to mandate pain protocol, or do you think this should be left in the hands of the medical community? Be very interested in the second hour in your opinions on that. In addition, the governor said we should divest our pension funds from coal and Exxon Mobil. Wanted to get your impression about that, because a couple of things you should know about that proposal. Many of the legislators we've talked to, and you remember we've talked to many of them over the last 2 weeks, are not supportive of this idea. Senator Mazza, Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, Senate Pro Tem John Campbell, and Treasurer Beth Pierce, including Minority Leader in the House Don Turner, have all come out against this, saying that it is unwise to put investments into a political arena, especially when the pension funds have funding problems. In fact, Treasurer Pierce has said that it is unwise, and we'll get into that as well. So my question in the second hour is, should we divest our pension funds from coal and Exxon investments? We'll reserve the whole entire second hour for that. But what I wanted to get to this morning is, what did you think about the debate last night? Many people have weighed in on the Democratic debate. Be interested in your opinion at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Bernie and Hillary went at each other last night, and most people are talking about it today. I did a quick scan of the newspapers, and I found that many people thought that Bernie had won the debate. The consensus was, at least among the politicos in the newspapers, including the Washington Post and others, was that Bernie was on his heels on the gun issue, but they thought he really took it to Secretary Clinton on campaign reform and Wall Street and the economy. Be very interested in what you saw, what you think about the debate last night. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. And of course, normally campaign reform and Wall Street would probably not be relevant in these kind of debates, but Sanders is doing something that is smart. He is saying that the system is rigged, that taking money from Wall Street is what's wrong with our system, with both the elected process and the economy. So he seized on this issue, that Wall Street, and he hit Secretary Clinton with the line that she takes money from Goldman Sachs, and how can you change a system that you're deeply involved with, that you're deeply aligned with? You know, Sanders has something here. I mean, people are peeved, and they want someone that is angry and will change the system. Bernie Sanders comes across as that person, that he is not invested in the old system of politics and the economy. So what do you think? Did you think that Bernie Sanders won the debate? Or do you think that Hillary Clinton won the debate? Or Martin O'Malley? Martin O'Malley complained that he didn't get enough time in the debate. That's understandable, given that he's about 3% in the polls, so he wouldn't get a lot of time. But he did complain about that time. So who won the debate? Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton? The number to call is 802-244-1777. Or toll free at 877-291-8255. You know, there's one thing in the debate that I wish someone would ask the question, and it deals with transparency in government. As you know, the United States government falls under the United States Freedom of Information Act, which was passed in 1966, and it's updated periodically. It's designed to give Americans access to public documents at the federal level. And the Freedom of Information Act allows us the opportunity, by getting that information, to hold federal government accountable. You know, documents that detail specific policy, documents that help us understand the reasoning and thinking behind laws, and much more. They're very useful in trying to find out, and very important to the American public in trying to find out what government is thinking. And yet, it's really, really interesting what's happening. Congress, whether it's Democrat or Republican-led, is equally guilty of trying to hide information from the public. This is amazing. Since enacting the Freedom of Information Act, both the House and the Senate have exempted themselves from its provisions. And the Associated Press last year had filed lawsuits with the State Department because they weren't getting information. And the White House is removing federal regulations that subjects its Office of Administration to the Freedom of Information Act, making official policy that existed under President Bush to reject records for that office. So I'm curious why one of those questions don't come up during the debate. A democracy, in my mind, a democracy is sustained and grows stronger when the public is properly informed about what the government is doing and how it's going about it, and secrecy and lack of transparency chips away, in my mind, at the democratic values. I get it. Sometimes there are times, like national security issues, for example, that some information must be withheld. But most understand this type should be temporary non-disclosure. At some point, these records should be made public. And the trend that we're seeing is that federal agencies are becoming more emboldened to withhold information from the public. This is information that's not relevant to national security and should be released. In my mind, this is having a corrosive effect on the country. When there is accountability, there is less, when there is a less accountability, when there's a lack of accountability, there's less trust in the government. I wish somebody would ask those questions of both the Republicans and Democrats of what they would do with the Freedom of Information Act. So what I'm asking this morning is, what did you think of the debate? Was Bernie on his heels on the gun issue? Do you think Secretary Clinton was on her heels on Wall Street and the economy? This is the question that we'll explore. And this is the question that I want to know. Who won the debate? Sanders says the system is rigged and it needs to be changed. That taking money from Wall Street, as Hillary Clinton has done, is what's wrong with the country. And it's what's wrong with the economy. It's what's wrong with the elected process. So give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Coming up, we'll speak with Mark Redman, the Executive Director of Spectrum Youth and Family Services, to talk about what his organization does, how it does it, and the trends he is seeing in our troubled youth population. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. As I said in the second hour, we'll get to some of the questions that I asked just a little while ago. But first up, Mark Redman, the Executive Director of Spectrum Youth and Family Services, to talk about what his organization does, how it does it, and the trends he's seeing in our troubled youth population. And before I introduce you, Mark, and say hello, just want to disclose that I used to be on the Spectrum board, but I'm no longer on that board. Welcome, Mark Redman.
Mike, thanks for having me on.
What does Spectrum do? What services do you offer?
We work with teenagers and young adults. We start as young as age 14, and we go up to as old as 26. I would say our sweet spot is really like that 17 up to 22 population. And it's young people who could be homeless or runaways, in or exiting the foster care system, kids who've gotten in trouble and they're in the juvenile justice system, they're in the court system, kids who dropped out of high school, kids who are addicted to drugs, or kids who suffer from mental illness. And I always tell people, it's rare for a young person to just be one of those things. You know, most of the time, it's a homeless young person who's also addicted to drugs, or a runaway who also suffers from mental illness, or a kid who's in foster care who dropped out of high school, or several of those things. Our main base is in Burlington, which is the state's largest city. It makes sense. But we also have some staff in St. Albans, too. And we help those kids in a variety of ways. People drive by our drop-in center on Pearl Street downtown, and they see that and they think, oh, that's Spectrum. And it is Spectrum, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. That drop-in center is open every day, free hot lunch, free hot dinner. Come in and get warm clothing, take a shower, do your laundry. You can use our computers. We'll help you look for work, help you get back to school. But that's just one little aspect of what we do. Upstairs in that, we have a shelter that's open every day where 8 young people can come in out of the cold and the rain and live. And then from there, they move to a series of other houses that we have. Community Health Center Burlington runs a free health clinic right in our building there that's open 5 afternoons a week. We have our own addiction and mental health counseling unit. We have a mentoring program. So Spectrum's a lot of different things affecting a lot of different young people and teenagers.
Over the years, have you seen a trend in for these services? Has it been increasing? Has it been decreasing? What has happened over the years in terms of this, the youth that you serve?
A lot of it follows poverty. Not all of the kids who come to us are from poverty, but I would say the vast majority are from poverty. And in 2008 and 2009, when poverty got worse in our state and in the country, the number of young people ending up homeless and needing our services definitely jumped up. And that was true for the entire country, because I follow these things nationally. And that went up. I would say in terms of like really homeless and on the street, it kind of leveled off by like 2009, 2010. It didn't get better, it didn't go down, but it didn't get worse. So I would say it follows poverty trends a lot. And as the economy's gotten more difficult, it's been more difficult for families, which means you end up having more homeless youth.
And what do you do how do you move them through your system to gather? How do you measure success? How do you gain success with these individuals?
That's a good question. So let's say for homeless young people. So we have a drop-in center, okay? And we call it low barrier. We don't even need to know your name. We don't need your social security number. We don't need your medic. You know, it's come on in. We have mostly young staff. And come have a sandwich, have something to eat. These are young people who've been through a lot of different systems. They've been through the foster care system. They've been in the children's mental health system, school systems. They haven't had good experience with those systems or with adults. So we want to establish a relationship with them. From there, if they're truly homeless, they will probably come and live in our shelter. And we start there. Now when you're in our shelter, we're going to up the ante a bit. Okay, we do need to know your name and your social security number, and we're going to help. With the message we're going to give you is this isn't just about getting out of the cold and the snow for one night. How do we put together a whole plan around jobs, around education, if addiction is an issue, around treatment, if mental health is an issue, around mental health care, life skills? And we say the shelter is a good place to start. We'll help you look for work, to go to school. And then from there, we have 2 different houses. And you should think about moving to those houses, because there you'll actually get the key to the front door, the key to your own apartment. You'll pay 1/3 of your income in rent. We'll ask you to start a bank account. We'll ask you to do volunteer service in the community, so you're not just receiving help, you're giving back. And we really work on those life skills. What a credit card is. How to avoid credit card debt, what financial aid is for school, saving money, what you do when you lose your Social Security card, how to drive a car. I always say I was lucky I had parents to teach me those things. And there they can stay in those houses for up to 18 months or 24 months. So again, and then when they leave us at the end, Mike, they get what's called a Section 8 voucher, where they can go and get subsidized housing in the Burlington area. Other kids, I have a young woman in the United States Navy right now who used to be with us. We've had kids in college campuses. So to me, what I like about Spectrum, it's that comprehensive approach. It's not just a place to live. It's about work. It's about saving your money. It's about continuing your education. And we're always offering the next step. You know, you start in the drop-in center, and then you can move to the shelter. And then you could move to these other houses. Then you move to your own. You know, we're always giving kids a carrot. We've actually had young people come back, go through that whole system, in a year or two later, come back and work for us as counselors.
We're speaking with Mark Redman, who is the executive director of Spectrum Youth and Family Services. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255, toll free. It's Spectrum Youth and Family Services. Where does the family come into this?
We, as much as we can, we try and work with the families, especially in our counseling program. In our counseling program, we'll see about 400 young people over the course of a year. Some of those are homeless kids. Some of those, like the kids I just described, we'll see hundreds of other young people who come from, some of them come from middle class, some come from wealthy families. And those kids are suffering from addiction. And often it's addiction and mental health difficulties. So all of our counselors are duly licensed in addiction counseling and mental health counseling, because we know that often underneath the addiction is some undiagnosed mental health concerns, such as depression, anxiety disorder. Maybe it's bipolar that's never been diagnosed. So we want to have everybody, all of our counselors trained in both and treat both sides of that coin. And if we can involve the family, we will. We know the family is going to be key in terms of that young person's recovery. So when you come into our building at Elmwood Avenue and you see our waiting room there, you'll often see young people and you'll often see family members there also.
You mentioned all the various things that you look at in a youth that is coming your way. What's probably the number one reason why kids are homeless?
Boy, that's a good question. I would say family dissolution. You know, when you look, a lot of the kids were in the foster care system, and they've kind of bounced around from home to home to home. So that's a big driver. The other driver is the mental health system. This is true for Vermont. It's true for the country. We have a children's mental health system. And in Vermont is actually, I think, a good system. We have some great programs like the Howard Center, Washington County Mental Health, Laraway. Those are great programs. Unfortunately, in the United States, once you hit 18, now you're eligible for the adult mental health system. And frequently, the diagnosis that a young person had to allow them to get help up to 18 won't allow them into the adult system. So they're X'd out of the adult mental health system. And a lot of those kids become homeless. And frankly, a lot of those young people end up in prison. You know, they'll eventually do something wrong. And our prisons in America, unfortunately, have become the new adult mental health system. And it's true for Vermont, and it's true for the country, and it's really a tragedy. So I would say those two things, family instability leading to foster care, and then the mental health system, are two big drivers.
You talked about how a youth will move through the system and various, and how services sort of connect in. How do you measure success? How do you determine, well, that's a success?
Right. So we look for, so in terms of housing, we look for what we call safe exits. So we measure each young person when they leave. Are they going to a safe place? So we're able to measure that. The state legislature 2 years ago enacted, you probably know this, the results, a law mandating what's called results-based accountability. So if you're accepting any kind of government dollars, you have to develop outcomes on everything you're doing and then develop trend lines. So we do, we're now down to about half of our funding is from state or federal sources, but we do RBA for all of our programs anyway, because you were on our board. I want to be able to report to our board, how do we define success in our counseling program? How do we define it in our mentoring program? In our drop-in center, every single thing we do. So we have measures now and we have trend lines. We've really gotten very serious about it in the last year, especially since the legislature passed that bill. So that, to me, we have different measures for each program. So it's funny, I had a funder walk in my office on Friday, and he kept looking over my shoulder. And now I know what he was looking at. I have up on my wall all these trend lines for all of our different programs. And as a funder from a corporation, he's I hope he was pleased. I was like, good, he runs his business like I run mine. We have to look what's success and how do we measure it.
We're speaking with Mark Redman, who's the executive director of Spectrum Youth and Family Services. If you wish to join our conversation, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. What is the most satisfying story you can remember that you've realized, you know, I'm in the right kind of business?
I see satisfying stories all the time at Spectrum. It's so nice. You know, we'll talk a bit later about my podcast, but I'm about to record a new podcast, and it's the story of a young woman who came to Spectrum. I think I was there about 2 years, and she showed up at our door, and she had spent 10 years living away from her home, came from an alcoholic family, really 18, couldn't go back to live with her family. And the girl had suffered from all kinds of psychiatric problems. And our staff at first were quite afraid to even take her in. She had so many presenting problems. But she did, we did give her a shot. And she stayed with us. And she did really well. She lived with us for like 2 years. And then she left to go on her own. And back, people always ask me, do you follow these kids after they leave? And back then we didn't. Now we do. We actually keep tabs on kids up to age 26. We have the funding to do that through donated dollars. And but you hope, you know, you hope she did well. And about 2 years ago, I'm in line at the DMV in South Burlington to renew my license. And I get there at 7:30. That's when it opens. I hate to wait on lines. And the line is snaking through the building. And who's standing next to me shoulder to shoulder but this young woman, you know? This is like 8 years later. And I saw her. I gave her a big hug. And I said, how are you? And she said, I'm still working. I love my job. She said, I'm married. I have 2 little boys. And it was just so nice. And then they called my number at the DMV, and I had to leave, you know. And as I drove away, I thought, gosh, I remember, you know, 7 or 8 years ago and how afraid we were to take this girl in with all her problems and all her difficulties. She used to cut herself, and I was just so glad, you know, that we did take a chance on her, you know. And it really is a testament to the, first of all, her own resilience. We talk about that a lot. How do we build resilience in people? But also the healing power of relationships. How the staff at Spectrum are so compassionate and so kind and treated her so well and really gave her maybe love for the first time in her life, and how healing that was for her and allowed her to construct a life for herself. So that to me is a, I mean, I could tell you 15 stories like that, but that's one that, that pops to mind.
What does failure with a kid, how does that affect you?
It's awful. You know, there's a warming shelter in Burlington now. COTS is running it this year. Champlain Valley Office of Economic Opportunity ran it last year. It's for people really homeless, nowhere to go in the middle of the winter when it's freezing. And I volunteered there last winter. I got there at 5 in the morning. And I'm sitting there on the couch having coffee, talking to somebody who's there, one of the men who'd stayed there overnight. And about halfway through the conversation, I thought, oh my gosh, I know this person. I remember him when he was a kid at Spectrum 8, 9 years ago. And I just felt so bad, you know, that he had ended up in this situation where he had to stay at a warming shelter. So that just really hits home, you know, when you think, what could we have done differently? What could we have done better? I don't know. In this line of work, you're not going to succeed with every single person. But it still, it really hurts. It hurts me personally when you think, wow, here's somebody who it didn't work for, you know.
How did you get in the profession, and what is your background?
So I have... You're going to laugh. I have a degree in finance from Villanova University. I was president of the Finance Society, and I had a job on Madison Avenue in an apartment off of Park Avenue in the 1979. And a friend of mine was working at this shelter for homeless kids called Covenant House in Times Square. And she said, hey, we could use some volunteers. So I thought, all right, I'll go over there one night a week after work. I'll take a different subway. I'll change it. I'll play basketball and hand out snacks. And then I started doing that, and after a while I realized that's really what I wanted to do with my life and not work at a multi-billion dollar corporation.
And how did you get to Spectrum from New York City?
So, well, I was working right outside. I left Covenant House after a few years, and I was working. I helped start the first charter school for low-income middle school kids in Stamford, Connecticut. Did that, and then I got married. My wife is pregnant, and I called a woman who ran what's called the New England Network, and I said, what opportunities anywhere in New England, anywhere, Maine, New Hampshire? And she said, there's a rumor, this place in Burlington called Spectrum may be looking for an executive director. I'll let you know if it's true or not. So it was true. I didn't even know about Spectrum. I'd only been to Burlington once in my life, and I was one of 36 candidates, and I got the job. So that's how I ended up here. It was minus 30 the day I moved up, Mike.
And you've been at Spectrum how many years now?
13 years. I can't believe it.
We're speaking with Mark Redman, who's the executive director of Spectrum Youth and Family Services. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. In a moment, we'll continue our conversation with Mark Redman This is Open Mic.
Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking this morning with Mark Redman, the Executive Director of Spectrum Youth and Family Services. If you wish to join our conversation, and we'd be delighted if you would want to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Mark, over the years, the distribution of funding has sort of changed dramatically in your organization. Can you explain how you used to be funded and now how you're now funded?
So when I got to Spectrum 13 years ago, it was about the same size budget, around $3 million, a little bit more. And it was 97% federal and state dollars, 2% United Way, and 1% private donations. That is now, that 97% is down to about 50% federal and state dollars. And then we still get 2% for United Way. And now, thankfully, through the generosity of people in Vermont and elsewhere, we are, you know, the rest is all private donations, corporations, foundations. So that we are very, very fortunate. You know, that first year, I remember we raised, $49,000 in donations, and we were ecstatic. This past year, we raised $1.3 million in donations. We've got to hit 1.5 this year that we're in now, the fiscal year. And that's to keep funding all the different things. And we've seen a dramatic decrease, especially in federal funding. There was federal grants, you know, we would count on. They'd be renewed every 3 years, five. But we always knew we were going to get them. And one by one by one, we've seen those fall away. And we're seeing that in other organizations, too. You know, the VNA had a $450,000 grant that helped fund their family room. That's gone. Howard Center, I forget how big their grant was. It was for opiate reduction work, their safe recovery program. They're, you know, closing or laying off staff, reducing hours at a time when we have opiate overdoses more than ever. And this is all what's happening on the federal level. And, you know, a lot of the nonprofits, including I, we run to the state, hoping the state can rescue. But the state has limited dollars, too. So this is a challenge for nonprofits. So we're very fortunate. We have a good reputation of some very, very generous people. And that's what's really keeping things going for us.
How do you fundraise?
I spend a lot of my time going out, meeting with donors, potential donors. You know, we have our sleep out coming out. It's March 31st this year. Mike is one of the founding fathers of the sleep out. He did the first one in 2012. I remember you drove all the way from Portland, Maine to be there for our sleep out. And that year we had 40 of us. Remember? It was something we tried. I saw it on Facebook that Covenant House did it. I thought, let's try it in Burlington. And we had 40 people, so and that raised $90,000. Last year's sleep out, we had 108 people out in that lawn, 380 high school, middle school students all around Vermont sleeping out in football fields, little league fields, backyards, and that sleep out raised $245,000 for us.
And can you explain what that, I mean, people come out and sleep the night to experience what it's like.
That's right. We do it in the winter, and I said, no, we allow the kids to use tents on the Little League fields, but the adults, no tents, okay? We do provide a little canopy, but no sides. I said to my staff, I want that wind to come whipping off of Lake Champlain, and you're out there in the cold and the snow. We give a tarp and a cardboard box you can put under you, and it's like you've been there. It starts like a pep rally. It's fun. Everybody's laughing, but by the time you actually lay down on that Unitarian lawn in Burlington, and it's, you know, 10 degrees, 20 degrees, wind chill. You hear in the ambulances, you hear in the fire trucks, you hear in the people get out of the bars, and the wind and the lights, you don't sleep. If you get an hour of sleep, you're lucky. And it really, it's good. It raises a lot of money for us. It's fun, but it also changes your perception of really how miserable it is to be homeless. And the thought of like getting up the next day and trying to function and work and go to school, it's really an eye-opener. So it raises a lot of money for us, but it also gives people a deeper understanding of how difficult life must be to be homeless.
What other events do you have to fundraise?
We do the Empty Bowl, and we do that always in October. Same thing. You know, we have tried bike rides. We've tried a dance-a-thon. We've tried a prom. None of them really made much money. We started the Empty Bowl a couple of years ago. Now we're on 8 years. It's donated soup, donated salad, donated bread. Okay, so it's not the chicken. We do it at the L.E. Long Center. It's for people and families. And it, when the, instead of a live auction, we put up on the board all the things we need. So driving lessons for kids, X dollars. Feeding kids, you know, for a week. And people bid on that. So instead of bidding to get, you know, a week's vacation in Nantucket, you're bidding to give something. That, so it's kind of a reverse of what we're used to in terms of fundraising dinners.
Last year, the legislature was looking at eliminating the deduction for charitable giving. And I gather that would be something you would be against, given that your fundraising is pretty prominent part of your budget now.
Yes, I am against that. All nonprofit leaders are against that. And partly I feel like, you know what? Okay, we have seen pretty dramatic decreases in federal funding and even sometimes in state funding. And I kind of feel like now to hold behind our back, you know, the one thing we've got available, which is to reach out to donors and try and get them to give. And anything that might dissuade them from giving or discourage them from giving is something that I'm not in favor of. So we have really, the nonprofit leaders have really tried to get around that. And let's try and keep that in the tax code if we can.
What's the pitch that you give to major donors?
My pitch to major donors is if you give to Spectrum, you're making an impact. You're changing lives. You know, we're helping to not only feed young people and get them off the street, get them off of drugs, but we're helping them to get jobs, get it back into school, and really get a foundation in life. You know, my pitch now, especially with our staff, is it's good that our kids work, but we've got to get them into jobs now that are going to provide them with a livable wage. You know, I have a young man right now I'm so proud of. He's at Vermont Tech studying to be a car mechanic, and he'll graduate from, he's getting straight A's. This is a guy who used to be homeless, nowhere to go. Now he's getting straight A's. We have a young woman at UVM right now studying to be an elementary school teacher. You know, so a young man at NECI right now studying to be a chef. This is where we have to look. How do we give young people the training? We have a big divide in Vermont and in the country between the number of companies that desperately need trained, skilled workers. Not necessarily a four-year bachelor's degree, but maybe a two-year degree with training. And that's my goal. How do we get young people who've been struggling into those kind of training programs and jobs so they can really make it there? And that's my pitch to donors.
We're speaking with Mark Redman, who is the Executive Director of Spectrum Youth and Family Services. If you wish to join our conversation, call us at our WDEV studios at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. There are so many services for different age groups within Chittenden County and elsewhere in Vermont. How do you integrate with each other to make sure there's no duplication?
That's a good question. There are some great, especially like we're in Chittenden County mostly. Sorry, you have some great nonprofits like the Boys and Girls Club, King Street, Sarah Holbrook, you know, Mercy Camp. They're all out there. I think it's really important, and I think we do a good job of really collaborating together, figuring out what is your niche, who do you work with, what's Spectrum's niche. How can we transition some of those kids? We just started a new program a few months ago called the Multicultural Youth Program because, frankly, at Spectrum, we weren't seeing many multicultural youth coming in our doors. So we started this new program, and we met with King Street. We went over there, and we met with Boys and Girls Club. And they were very happy to have us come there because they work mostly with some younger kids. We want to be able now to integrate and kind of hand off as those kids get to be 15, 16, 17 and have different needs. And how can Spectrum? So for me, that's the key is communication and collaboration. So I don't think we are tripping over each other. I think we do a good job of that. Our medical clinic right in our building is Community Health Center of Burlington. We work hand in glove with COTS. We work hand in glove. Our jobs program, it helps kids look for work. It's a collaboration with the Howard Center. Half the employees work for Howard, half work for us. They're all in the Spectrum building. So I feel like there is a really good spirit of collaboration among the youth serving nonprofits in Burlington and throughout the state.
Mark, what's your greatest challenge?
I think for me, the greatest challenge is, number one, this the funding is a big challenge. I don't think this is a blip. I think this is the new norm in terms of especially the lack of federal funds that we're seeing. That's a challenge. And definitely, Mike, the whole opiate thing. You know, we the whole state's been affected by that. The whole country's been affected by that. We've been affected by that, too. The number of young people who are coming in who are addicted to opiates. That's a big challenge.
We're speaking with Mark Redman, who is the executive director of Spectrum Youth and Family Services. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Richard in Morrisville. Richard, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hello. You know, what you speak of, I'm 86 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I was born in 1930. So I've seen a lot of things go by. Some wide open or eyes open, and some that I didn't witness very accurately. But I've seen that history, and there's the revolution occurred in the 60s. I mean, that was a big time for the drug culture, and the culture of which you now speak began in reality. So there was a huge transition in our society, and what did we lose when the revolution hit? When, you know, in the 60s, when the revolution really bloomed, and we've seen the baby boomers come into that era, and just what happened? That's my question. What happened?
Thanks, Richard. I think what Richard is talking about is the explosion of the sort of the drug culture in the 60s.
Mm-hmm,
and is
mm-hmm.
this are what you are seeing, is that the after effect of the 60s?
I think you're right. I mean, I was a kid in the 60s. I was in grade school when all that went down. But certainly, yeah, I would say the drug culture certainly started to emanate from then. Although we always had an alcohol culture, you know. And there's so many kids who come into Spectrum, they have drug problems and they have alcohol problems too. So I think we've struggled as a society with why is there a certain percentage of the population that does become addicted, whether if it's alcohol or whether it's drugs. It's been a problem for generations.
Thanks, Richard, for your call. If you were governor, Mark, what would you change?
Oh, boy. If I was governor, what would I change? Oh, man. I think in the field that I work in, I would, again, money's really tight. I wouldn't want to be a legislator right now. They have such difficult choices to make. I believe that we need some version of what we have in Burlington at Spectrum in every major metropolitan area. We do have staff in St. Albans working with young people in foster care. They and other officials in St. Albans have asked me many times for Spectrum to open up some kind of a drop-in center, some kind of a shelter in St. Albans. I've gotten calls from Rutland. I've gotten calls from Barrie. I think every city in the state is struggling with what do we do with this age 16 up to 22 population that's either homeless, disconnected, addicted, whatever it is. And I would love to see funding to really be able to expand and to recreate some version of those services in all those areas.
You are now podcasting, from what I understand. Can you explain what the podcast is all about, what the audience you hope to reach, and hopefully you won't become my competitor?
Well, let me explain for some of your listeners what a podcast is. A podcast is to radio is as a DVR is to TV. Think of a DVR, right? My wife and I love to watch the CBS Evening News. We're not always home at 7 p.m. to watch it. We DVR it so we can watch it later and skip through the commercials. On radio, right, you may have a favorite show that you like to listen to, but maybe you don't have a radio nearby. So more and more shows are podcasting. Democracy Now! Is on here at 5:30 every day. If I'm not in the car at 5:30, I can play the Democracy Now! Podcast.
Just a minute before you start explaining your podcast. We do podcast Open Mic, and if you want to listen to the podcast, go to WDEVradio.com, go to the Open Mic icon, and click on that icon, and you can listen to the show anytime at your pleasure. But let's talk about your podcast.
That's great. I didn't know you were doing that. So my podcast, here's how it started. Have you ever heard of The Moth? Have you ever heard of The Moth?
Yes.
Yeah, The Moth is real people telling real stories. It's one of the top podcasts. It's one of the top. It's on 200 different radio stations in the country. And at the end of the month, they'll always say, if you have an interesting story, call this number. You have 1 minute. And I did that. And they emailed me back and invited me to be one of their storytellers at the Flynn in 2013. And one of the other tellers, storytellers they brought in was from Chicago. And he liked my story. And at the end, he said, you know, you should do what I'm doing. You should do a podcast. And I said, well, I'm not part of a radio station. He said, all you need is a good microphone, your own laptop, and just record them and go on SoundCloud and start a podcast like I do. That's what he did. So I started doing that. I launched my first one in January. It's called So Shines a Good Deed, which is a line from a movie that you may know. And it's really stories about the young people that I've worked with for over 35 years. I really believe part of my mission, just as a human being, is to give people hope. You know, we live in sometimes desperate times and sad times and ISIS and global warming, and I think people need hope, and they need to know that even people in desperate situations can survive and thrive. And that's really what my pod, not all of them are uplifting. There are some sad stories, because that's also the reality of the kind of work that I do. But I started this podcast, and it seems to be gaining traction, and I'm thrilled with it.
You talked about if you were governor that you would expand into other communities, but would there be any other services you would expand into as well?
I would think, well, we love mentoring. We do mentoring. When I started at Spectrum, we had 6 mentors, and we're now up to 75. These are people who have all raised their hand and said, yes, I'll be a volunteer mentor for at least 1 year for a young person. And we kind of reel them in on the 1 year promise. And now I have mentors who have been doing it for 6, 7, 8 years. Bob Wheel is one of our mentors. He was named Mentor of the Year for the entire state of Vermont. Beautiful ceremony in Montpelier last week. And he's been mentoring a 14-year-old boy. I think mentoring is just, first of all, it's cost effective. And it's a wonderful way to help young people.
I want to thank Mark Redmond, the Executive Director of Spectrum Youth and Family Services, and talking about his organization, what he does, the trends that he's seen in troubled youth in Vermont. Thanks, Mark.
Mike, thanks for having me on.
Coming up, we'll talk. We'll have this conversation about the Governor's State of the State Address, about limiting pain medication, perhaps even Bernie's performance last night at the debates. And also back to the state of the state about divesting from pension funds. We'll set that all up in the second hour. We'll take your calls in the second hour to explore those questions together. And again, Mark has talked about his podcast. I want to talk about our podcast. You can listen to Open Mic at your pleasure anytime by going to the WDEVradio.com website and clicking on the open mic icon and going to any show that you desire. This is Open Mic on WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com, and I would urge you to go to that website and click on the Open Mic podcast and listen to this show or any show that you desire. When we come back, we'll be taking your phone calls about the Governor's State of the State address on limiting pain medication. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Talk Media News is taking the day off, so we'll go right into this second hour. And for the second hour, I want to take your phone calls, but let me set it up a little bit. I realized over the weekend that things have been so busy that we really haven't had the opportunity to weigh in on the Governor's State of the State speech. And there were a couple things in that speech that I really wanted to get your opinion on. With the budget speech coming up on Thursday, I really wanted to focus in on taking some time today and exploring together some of the things said in the Governor's State of the State address. And one of the things that he proposed was to mandate that medical professionals could only prescribe 10 pills for pain for minor
procedures. And here's what he said, the governor said, and I'll quote it, and this is, quote, first, we are putting an end to the system where doctors, dentists, and healthcare providers send patients home with 80 or 90 pills in their pocket. I am proposing a new system where a maximum of 10 pills will be the limit for minor procedures. We're also looking at reasonable limits for more major procedures that provide pain relief without filling up our medicine cabinets with unused opiates. That's just Vermont common sense. And if you've listened on the last couple of Fridays when we have talked about this with legislators, there seems to be some legislative support in this direction. And if you read some of the editorials, it is interesting. I'm quoting from the Valley News here. And I'm not going to quote the whole editorial, but I'll highlight some of the things that they said. But it was another initiative that caught our attention. The governor's proposal to create a new system for prescribing opiates. 2 years ago, Shumlin made national headlines by devoting his entire state of the state message to addressing the epidemic of drug addiction gripping Vermont. At that point, Shumlin, and it goes on to talk about the fact that Shumlin over the years, over the last few years, has really taken on the Food and Drug Administration, which he accused of lighting the match that it ignited America's opiate and heroin addiction crisis, by what is in this Valley News editorial as by approving what Shumlin is talking about is by approving, beginning in the 1990s, a class of powerful and powerfully addicted opiate painkillers such as OxyContin were introduced. And what Governor Shumlin is saying is that he is going after the pharmaceutical industry and declaring that it's a knows no shame in terms of its culture, and declared that, and this is quote, until America is willing to have an honest conversation about the way that we are dealing with pain, our challenges will continue. And to help remedy this situation, the governor, and I'm quoting the Valley News here, the governor advocates several steps, including putting an end to the system where doctors, dentists, and healthcare providers send patients home with 80 to 90 pills in their pocket. He proposes a limit of 10 pills for minor procedures and reasonable limits for more major ones that provide pain relief without filling up our medicine cabinets with unused opiates. This recommendation will not be embraced enthusiastically by the medical community can perhaps be inferred from the comments of Dr. Deb Richter, a longtime Shumlin supporter who was in the audience. She told 7 Days that while it's good to prompt providers to review their prescribing practices, she did not favor dictating how many pills doctors could prescribe. Given that effective and compassionate medical care is an art as well as a science, her reservations are understandable. So wanted to get your opinion today. Do you think this is a good idea to mandate pain protocol, or do you think this should be left in the hands of the medical community? If you wish to join our conversation, if you have a comment, if you have an opinion on who should be dictating or mandating pain protocol, should it be left in the hands of the doctors, or should government be prescribing the pain protocol? The number to reach us is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. The Valley News also went on to say that, on the other hand, the medical profession has invited such scrutiny by overprescribing opiates, which in turn has contributed to the addiction crisis nationwide that policymakers must grapple with. So there is a legitimate state interest in limiting their use. In this instance, it seems to us a reasonable middle course would be to establish guidelines for prescribing from which healthcare providers could depart but only by specifically documenting their reasons for doing so. This would preserve their independence while accomplishing at least some of what Shumlin speaks. So be interested in your opinion. Do you think this is a good idea for government to mandate pain protocol, or do you think this should be left in the hands of the medical community? Welcome your phone calls at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Again, the question, do you think this is a good idea for government to mandate pain protocol, or do you think this should be left in the hands of the government? And there's been some reaction to various people. I mean, not only Dr. Deb Ricker has talked about the need to be careful with this and keep this in the hands of the doctors, but also some people that have been in pain have been fairly concerned about this process. So let's go to the phone lines. Let's go to Rich in Starkesboro. Rich, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. How are you today?
Great, thank you.
I'd like to talk about a situation with my wife. It was back in 2011. She had breast surgery for cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there with her, and we're kind of getting close to time to check out and come home and stuff. And this guy came up with two cards of oxycodone. We looked at him, like, what is this? And our initial response is he was like in cahoots with the underground drug program. He was just trying to infiltrate the system. And then the nurse was kind of rolling her eyes, what's all this? And so we went back, and I think we either got a much smaller amount, we were like, two of those bubble wrap cards, or we didn't get any or something like that. But I don't really, we're talking about, as you said, pills to go home in your pocket. And I think the governor is right. You only need about 10 in your pocket to go home. That gives you 2-3 days to go to a drugstore and get your prescription filled if you need more. And they can give you the prescription. If you don't need it after taking those 10, you don't even go get it filled. What do you think?
So, Rich, you think the governor is right on that? I'm actually throwing the question out to all our listeners today.
Yeah. 'Cause one of the things about it is, we've got this system of, where the drug companies are really kind of in the pocket, not in the pockets, but they're right in their offices with all their drug promotion programs. And if you recall, maybe 10 years ago, the legislature tried to pass a law saying that they had to divulge, the amount of money they spend on doctors trying to promote their product, and the drug companies were successful in striking that law down. And, so this is just more of the drug companies pushing their product out there, and another thing, too, deal where you once a year or something, the state police have this turn in your extra prescription drugs day. I don't see why they can't do that every day, because why does it have to be a special day? We had some from when my mother passed away. She had a bunch of oxycodone. We nearest place we could find was down at the Ludlow Town Police Station where we could turn them in. The state police only does it once a year.
That's a little ways from Starkesboro, isn't it, Rich?
Yeah.
Hey, thank you very much for your phone call, Rich. Let's go to Fred in Williston. Fred, you're on open mic.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have interesting perspective. I have my wife is a physician in the family,
mm-hmm.
and we also have an opioid user in the family. So my daughter, who's got her master's from UVM, got her wisdom teeth out 14 months ago, was given the fistful of OxyContin, and we find out in November that she's been using heroin for 9 months.
Mm.
She's been positive in detox, and she said to me, that stuff was so powerful, she said, I just could not control it, and I was so embarrassed I couldn't come to you. And that's one perspective. Good kid, good family, intelligent girl, could not control it. On the other factor, I totally agree with Governor Shumlin's proposal. I will tell you that the way opioids are prescribed amongst prescribers is or providers is runs the full spectrum. You have some doctors who will only give you a few. You'll have some doctors will give you 3 months' supply. And I think it definitely needs to be regulated. If a person has a pain issue after a few days worth of, maybe 10 or 12 tablets, let's say 3 or 4 days worth of pain medicine, then it should just be standard operating procedure that the doctor recommends that person to a pain management physician. They need to get this out of the clinic and into the hospitals and managed by people who that's their job and people who are cognizant of the dangers of this type of medication. So that's all I have to say.
Fred, thank you so much for your phone call. Appreciate it. Very good perspective from both sides that you're giving here, Fred. What we're asking today is Governor Shumlin has proposed limiting a maximum of 10 pills for minor procedures, prescribing 10 pills, pain pills for minor procedures. And wanted to get your perspective on this proposal in the State of the State address. So my question is, do you think this is a good idea for government to mandate pain protocol, or do you think it should be left in the hands of the medical community? Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Fred in Moncton Ridge. Fred, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. I'm a little ambivalent about both sides of the thing. I don't want Dick Massa's good guy, but he's a meat cutter. I don't want him to make a decision about pain medicine. The lieutenant governor, he runs a backhoe. I don't want him making a decision about my pain medicine. I want less pain medicine out there, but I do not think that this group is the group to regulate it. Let's get a group of doctors, not detail men. Those are the guys that work for the drug company, the detail guys.
Mm-hmm.
And let's get a group of physicians, local people, whatever it takes to get this thing so we've got a handle on it. But just getting a bunch of meat cutters and a bunch of people that are, they're not the guys. This is not their profession. It takes an angel and a devil at the same time to be a doctor. Look at the poor call you just got on the phone about the man who, his wife is an opiate doctor. The daughter's addicted to heroin.
Mm-hmm.
How much more sad, Mike, can that be?
Yeah. Fred,
I mean, that is tragic.
Fred, as always, appreciate your perspective. Thank you for your phone call. Let's go to Tom. I can't read that, and I'm sorry. You told me what it was, but
Jamie.
Let's go to Jamie. Jamie, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hi, Mike. How are you today?
Great, thank you.
Good. I'm glad you've got this conversation going because I think it's got some there's some real issues involved here. Let me just answer a question for the guy from Starkesboro, first of all. And in the police department in Winooski has a depository for unwanted pills and stuff like that. And anybody can go in there 24 hours a day and drop off one or as many pills as you want to in their pill box. So he can get rid of his stuff there. The other thing that I just wanted to say is I had a knee replacement in 2007, and I was on, I don't know, oxycodone or OxyContin, whatever it was, for about 10 days, and then on Dilaudid for about 45 days. Dilaudid is synthetic morphine.
Mm-hmm.
And, I never took more than was prescribed. I never had an issue getting off it when I didn't need the pain medication anymore. But to only be able, if you have a knee replacement and you're on prescription pain medication as a result of it, you're going to be taking probably one pill every 4 to 6 hours. And, you know, if you got to go to the drugstore and get your prescription refilled every other day, that's a lot of work.
Yeah, I mean, it isn't explained in the governor's proposal that he mentioned in his State of the State address, but he says a maximum of 10 pills will be the limit for minor procedures. And then he says, we're also looking at reasonable limits for more major procedures that provide pain relief without filling up our medicine cabinets with unused opiates. I don't know where the knee operation, if that's a minor or a major sort of situation. The thing is here, though, they're trying to find ways to limit the number of pills. And what I hear you saying, Jamie, is that I gather what you're saying is leave it in the hands of the medical community.
I think that that's a real good idea, is to leave it in the hands of the medical community and let the physicians make decisions and not policymakers.
Hey, Jamie, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it. The question we're asking this morning, and have had great phone calls on this and would appreciate your opinion on it, is do you think this is a good... We're talking about limiting pain medication by legislation, and where a maximum of 10 pills would be limited for minor procedures, and also looking for reasonable limits for major procedures that provide pain relief without filling up our medicine cabinets with unused opiates. This is a governor's proposal. It seems to have some legislative support. Like I said, a lot of people have said that they think that this may be needed, as I talked to legislators on the two Fridays that we've been at the State House. So my question is this. Do you think this is a good idea for government to mandate pain protocol, or do you think this should be left in the hands of the medical community? If you've got an opinion, if you've got a comment, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. We've had quite a diverse amount of opinion here. So want to get your opinion on this proposal. Tom, let's go to our next caller. And you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hi, is it me?
Yep, it's you.
Hi, my name is Freya, and I'm calling from Hardwick.
Good morning.
I feel pretty strongly that it should be left in the hands of the medical providers. And I'm speaking from experience, because I'm a recovering addict, and it took me a really long time to seek help. And I was never one of those people that went home with 80 pills in my pocket. I always was with strict doctors who sent me home with 10, if I was lucky. And because of my addictive nature, I would seek anyway, because that's how I am. Not everyone's like that. The other thing that I would say is, because I'm from a rural area, my mother has a chronic pain condition right now, and she's required to take long-term pain medication. She has no car. And with those types of restrictions, it would make it very difficult for her to obtain her medicine. So I really think it should be up to the discretion of the doctors. And I agree that things definitely need to change, absolutely. But I don't think that the government should be in charge of it. I just think that's just going to cause more trouble for suffering people.
Thank you for calling in, and thank you for your perspective, given what you disclosed here on the air. I really appreciate your phone call. Let's go to Don in Morrisville. Don, you're on open mic.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
You know, one of the things that perhaps we need to think about with this sort of thing, and it's not just this, it's all regulation. All regulation is usually brought about because somebody has overstepped the bounds. And I think some of the doctors have really overstepped the bounds on this. I understand what people are saying when they feel that the doctors should be able to regulate it, and I certainly think they should have input into it. But to have a board or a group of only doctors to decide this issue, I think is a mistake. There needs to be public input into it as well, and if necessary, the public need to control the spread of this sort of thing needs to take preponderance. That's just the way I see it. I just can't understand the way some of these doctors are today. Granted, they're all not like that, but I mean, look at the way we've had troubles with some of these doctors on Medicare fraud too. So are we supposed to just let them go and not have any regulation on Medicare fraud? I see that as not that much different from having doctors that are putting pills out there where they just plain should not be.
Don, thank you very much for your opinion. I really appreciate your call. Let's go to Matt across the pond in Plattsburgh. Matt, you're on open mic.
Hey, how's it going?
Great, thank you.
So unfortunately, I am from, you know, across the pond in New York, so I don't know if we have any bills that are like the one that we're discussing, but I think it's a really touchy subject. I mean, pain is such a hard thing to really judge. You know, everyone has their own threshold, but I think, you know, limiting how many pain pills you can get would be a great idea to help, you know, kind of get a handle on the epidemic that basically is sweeping the whole country. Personally, I am also a recovering addict, and I have been into inpatient facilities, and all the stories that I heard was, you know, people going in for simple procedures, and they just, you know, got too many pills from their doctors, and that's how they ended up getting hooked. I know people who have gone to doctors, and the doctors were just honestly too scared to not prescribe that many because they had already gotten in a mess where they were just giving them pills. I think it's just it's a really touchy subject, and until something like this, you know, proactively gets passed, we're just going to have a problem throughout the entire country. And I know Vermont is definitely in a big struggle with heroin, especially, and all opiates. But Plattsburgh, luckily, is starting to crack down on it. I think other cities in Vermont and other cities around New York are also starting to, but you know, a big thing that taking control of people's lives, and it's a tragedy to a lot of families too. So,
Matt, thank you so much for your phone call. Let's go to Greg in Warren. Greg, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. Just a couple comments. I see. You know, there's a big push to legalize weed now. And on the other hand, a lot of people are against a tighter control or regulation on one of the most addictive substances that we have in our country, and one that's causing a lot of heartache and crime and problems all across the country. But I think the way you've been posting or putting forward this issue makes it seem like by limiting the family physician's ability to give out a small amount of pills, that we're going to take that away from the doctors if there's regulation involved. And I don't think that's true, because I think what the idea is that this highly dangerous substance would be regulated by a pain management physician at a local hospital. And I think that's what we need in the state. We need more pain management physicians so that the local doctors can refer their patients to these specialists who know how to prescribe and monitor their patients on these drugs. And I don't think we're looking to take anything away from the doctor, the local doctor, except this, except putting this dangerous substance in the hands of a specialist who knows how to deal with it in a more expert manner.
Thanks, Greg. Appreciate the phone call. Let's go to Rick in Essex. Rick, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. My opinion is that any regulation that the government tries to impose is only going to make life much, much more difficult for those patients who have legitimate reasons for being on long-term pain, opiate pain medications. I guess I don't want to be too specific, but you know, my experience with a family member is that you know, maintaining things on, you know, for a chronic situation, the controls seem to be quite tight as it is, including regular appointments with the prescribing physician, not allowing more than a limited number of prescriptions to be written at a time, and I guess any regulation, my opinion is that it's going to make life more difficult for those people who, you know, who legitimately need a pain medication on a long-term basis.
Rick, thank you for your call. Appreciate your call. I appreciate all the calls that have come in, and some of them have been very touching in terms of the stories and the struggles that various people have gone through, and I appreciate you sharing those struggles with us. I know it's difficult, but certainly this is an important subject to talk about, and we'll continue talking about this in a moment. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Jay, just hold on a little bit. I'm going to just set this back up, and you're first in line, and I'll get right to you, Jay from Montpelier. The second, we've had a lively discussion here, and one of the discussion points that we've been talking about is taken from the governor's State of the State speech almost 2 weeks ago. And in that speech, he explored several things, threw out a couple of proposals, one of which was to mandate that medical professionals could only prescribe 10 pills for pain for minor procedures. Here's what the governor said. He said, first, we are putting an end to the system where doctors, dentists, and healthcare providers send patients home with 80 or 90 pills in their pocket. I am proposing a new system where a maximum of 10 pills will be the limit for minor procedures. We're also looking at reasonable limits for more major procedures that provide pain relief without filling up our medicine cabinets with unused opiates. That's just Vermont common sense. And as I mentioned in the top of the hour here, many legislators feel that this is a good idea that we have spoken through to so far. We do have a quote from Deb Ricker, a longtime Shumlin supporter, who was in the audience. She told 7 Days that while it's good to prompt providers to review their prescribing practices, she did not favor dictating how many pills doctors could prescribe. So my question is, do you think this is a good idea for government to mandate pain protocol, and the pain protocol being limiting the pills for pain for minor procedures, or do you think this should be left in the hands of the medical community? Let's go to Jay in Montpelier. Jay, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Hi, Mike. Actually, it's Jerry.
Jerry, I'm sorry.
No, it's all right. Number one, your previous caller who said, I don't know where his background is, but he said that marijuana is an addictive drug. I really would like to hear more about that. I don't believe it is, okay, but, you know, I don't know his background. The other thing is marijuana has already been legislative or as a medical option instead of painkillers and opiates and whatnot. I truly believe in medical marijuana as an organic substitute for Percocets or any else, you know, that you could get hooked on.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand why people have such a problem with marijuana. It's an organic thing that is helping people on cancer and other pain-related issues, and it is not addictive compared to other painkillers that are distributed by major companies in the United States that are controlling the issue. I really don't understand that. And I guess I'm saying this because I'm headed that way. I have cancer, and there's no way I want to take painkillers. There's no way I want to drink alcohol to kill my pain. Mm-hmm. If marijuana helps my pain and helps me get through my cancer, then who out there is to say that I shouldn't take it?
Jerry, but isn't it legal right now for you to take marijuana, because it is legal in the state of Vermont for medicinal purposes?
You would not believe what you have to go through. Mm-hmm. I'm just applying.
Okay.
And you would not believe what you have to go through. And it'll eventually probably happen. Okay. My insurance company won't pay for it because it's not federally legal. So, you know, I don't know what to say to you. I guess what I should say is you would have a different attitude about this if you were diagnosed with cancer and or pain. A lot of acute pain, which I also have through my arthritis, you would have a different attitude about it.
Hey, Jerry, thank you so much for your phone call. And it's these type of phone calls that I really appreciate, the people that are going through this. The question that I'm asking today is one of the things that the governor had proposed in a state of the state was that medical professionals could only prescribe 10 pills for pain for minor procedures. The governor wants to limit the 10 pills, will be limited to minor procedures. He's also looking at reasonable limits for major procedures that provide pain relief. And so my question is this. Do you think this is a good idea for government to mandate the pain protocol with these with things like OxyContin and those sort of drugs? Or do you think this should be left in the hands of the medical community? Let's go back to the phone lines and Duxbury, a call from Duxbury. You're on open mic. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I think the concept is a good one, but I think enacting some kind of policy is just going to be kind of a nightmare, and there's going to be a lot of pushback from people in the medical community. I had a really nasty dental issue a few years ago while I was traveling. I called my dentist here. He called the pharmacy in California where I was. The first prescription I got for pain was Tylenol with codeine. 6 hours later, I called my dentist back. I said, you know what? This isn't doing anything. I am dying. It's going to be 2 days before I can see a dentist. We got to do something better. And he did. He went to something much stronger. I think that kind of common sense goes a long way, and I think people that send a guy home, a person home from any kind of surgery or what have you, with a prescription to last 2 weeks, that's kind of nutty. And the second thing I would suggest is, while we're at it, you know, most of these, not always, but most often, if you're getting a pain meds prescription, you're having follow-up visits, and oftentimes that follow-up visit is well beyond when, you know, you've mended and you're back on your feet. That's the time for the nurse practitioner or the doctor, whoever, dentist, whoever it was, to say, look, if you've got any of those Percocets left, bring them in, and we'll take care of it for you. Mm-hmm. Instead of keeping them in the medicine chest. Anyway, that's a couple thoughts, and hate to say it, but I think the governor sometimes, you know, kind of starts firing away before he's taken the time to aim. But it seems to be another example of that. Thanks a lot for your show. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for the phone call. Let's go to Jay in Chelsea. Jay, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Mike. Thanks for taking my call. I had a comment and two questions here. The first comment is actually more people die from alcohol abuse than opioid abuse. So this tremendous focus on opioid abuse is questionable. The next thing is I wonder if we're mistaking for addicts. There's actually two types of addiction. There's a psychological addiction and there's an actual physical addiction. And I don't know where the actual science on OxyContin, but I don't think people become physically addicted from OxyContin and 90 pills. I personally have had a number of fractures in my life. I'm kind of an active person, and I was prescribed that. I've actually been prescribed a number of different things, and I found that OxyContin is, talking with doctors, it actually does not, it does a different thing than real opioids. It doesn't actually relieve the pain. It tries to tell your brain that you're not really in pain. And for me, that just did not work at all. So I'm really wondering if, the legislature, I see all the New England states and a lot of states, it seems like they want to go and try and do a tobacco thing and sue the pharmaceuticals. When really, I think what's actually driving this, the number one thing that happens is people get psychologically addicted to this stuff because it gives them a temporary respite from the misery of the unequal and very corrupt society that we have today. And you look around, and we've killed all our bats in this state. You know, people are aware that they're talking about worried about immigrants and stuff, and we have biological things because of all the things that the wealthy and affluent want to be able to import over here in just a day. And my other question is. I'd really like to know with doctors, a lot of this is actually put on them where they're not allowed to prescribe what they want. They're not really allowed, I think, to prescribe morphine, which I had at one point in time a lot of years ago in the 70s when I first had a fracture. That was actually very effective. But you are able to get a little bit at the start, and then they definitely reduce your dosage as you get better and stuff. So I'm wondering if doctors, if you were to ask them if they really have options, or are they kind of just forced to say, I can prescribe for pain now this OxyContin stuff, and I'm not really allowed to do anything else unless, you're dying from cancer or something.
Jay, thank you for your phone call. Very good question. And if anybody is out there in the medical community would like to hear from you on this proposal that the governor has submitted through his State of the State address, which says that it would mandate that medical professionals could only prescribe 10 pills for pain for minor procedures, and also that would look at reasonable limits for more major procedures that provide pain relief without filling up the medicine cabinets with unused opiates. So my question this morning is, do you think this is a good idea for government to mandate pain protocol, or do you think this should be left in the hands of the medical community? If you have an opinion, if you have a comment, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're having a very robust conversation today. I appreciate all the phone calls. We've got some lined up here, and I'll try to get to all of you. One of the things that the governor proposed in his State of the State was to mandate that medical professionals could only prescribe 10 pills for pain for minor procedures. Question I've thrown out today and gotten a lot of people calling in is, do you think this is a good idea for government to mandate pain protocol, or do you think this should be left in the hands of the medical community? Let's go to Sharon in Berlin. Sharon, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
I am fine, thank you.
Wonderful. I've been sitting here listening to this, and I remember back in the late 50s when the government took over to take care of the seniors.
Mm-hmm.
And doctors could not even prescribe an ointment to a senior if it was not on the government list. Mm-hmm. And government has been slowly doing this all these years, little by little. And doctors are trained at this. They know their medications. A government, people that have no idea of what the human body even does, are going to try to govern this? This is insanity. How long can people put up with having the government stepping on them?
So you're definitely in the category, I would think, Sharon, that you think it should be left in the hands of the medical community and not in government. Is that correct?
I was raised in medicine, yes, and my family's still in medicine. And it's getting harder and harder for doctors to even be able to do what they wish to do. They want their patients to be happy, healthy, and productive. But when you start stepping on people who are in a great deal of pain and you're saying, no, you can't have that, we've got a problem. It should be left to the medical society. This should not be even in political. I mean, you can see what's happened with insurance. This just does not work. And we're losing our medical people for that reason. They're starting to drop out of medicine. Pretty soon you're not going to have doctors or nurses.
Sharon, thank you so much for your phone call. I really appreciate it. This is a show that went very quickly today, and I thank you for your phone calls. And I thank those people who called in and talked about their personal struggles. That always adds relevancy to the conversation. It was a really good conversation that we had on something that hasn't gotten a lot of attention. And again, I appreciate the phone calls. I want to thank Mark Redman, the executive director of Spectrum Youth and Family Services, he came in and talked about what his organization does, how it does it, and the trends that he is seeing in our troubled youth population. And they are trying to meet the needs of homeless kids in the Chittenden County region, as well as Franklin County. They have a very active program to try to get those troubled youth population off the streets. This is Open Mic on WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I want to remind everybody of the podcast. You can go to the podcast by going to WDEVradio.com, click on the Open Mic podcast icon, and you can listen to this show at your convenience anytime. I'm hoping that you're going to listen to repeats of this show. So go on the website at WDEVradio.com and click on the Open Mic Podcast. I'm Mike Smith. We'll talk again tomorrow.